This is The Big Breakdown, a long look back at some of the biggest stories we're covering for you at the Hidden Killers Podcast and True Crime Today. This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Bruschi and Robin Drake.
The Lindsay Clancy trial are more than a week now into testimony at Plymouth Superior Court, and the prosecution has spent every one of those days building basically the same argument. If you're sitting there going, didn't we argue this yesterday? You're not alone. She was deliberate. She was meticulous. She planned it. But after a week of their own witnesses on the stand, some of what the jury is hearing sounds a lot more like the defense's case than the prosecution's. Eric Faddis is a defense attorney, former prosecutor, and he is with us to help us break down where this case is at, where this case is going now that we're thus far into it. Robin is away today, but he'll be back on Monday. Eric, let's start here. The prosecution obviously has built their entire first week around the one image of January 24th, 2023. Lindsay Clancy built a snowman with her kids. She texted photos to Patrick. He told the jury she was having one of her best days. She placed a takeout order, picked up medicine at CVS. He did. And then a couple hours later, all three of the kids were dead. Prosecution wants you to believe it was the best day ever. They keep going, it was the best day, because she was, and then she planned to kill her kids, that she was planning to kill her kids. And that was what part of made it the best day, that while she's building the snowman, she's sitting there thinking, gee, I can't wait for those exercise bands. Despite begging for help from anyone who would actually listen, isn't that the hardest part to sell to the jury, that she was suffering from psychosis, because it really kind of sounds like the actions of a person in the midst of a psychotic episode. If you're building a snowman with your kids and then you're killing them in the next breath, that sounds like psychosis to me. That doesn't sound like the best day ever. It doesn't feel like they're making their argument very strong to the jury. I don't know. That's my take. What's yours so far?
Yeah, Tony, the prosecution has done a great job so far at supporting the defense's case. That they started with Patrick Clancy, the husband. He was like the most sympathetic guy there is. Mm-hmm. Besides the children, he's the biggest victim there is in all of this. And he was almost every chance he could get making points that were helpful for the defense. And now that the prosecution has this kind of theory where they're like, hey, she was running these errands. She knew what she was doing. This was all on purpose and was going to crescendo into this like gleeful delight in the strangulation of her three children. It's just such a non sequitur. It goes so left that the jury is like, what? That story doesn't even logically follow.
I hope that's where they land with it. We obviously won't know till they go back there and start deliberating. Kevin Reddington stood up in front of the judge and told him his client does not contest the government's case in chief. She killed her kids. We know that. That has been established. Obviously, the prosecution wanted to get as much mileage out of that as they could because it's heartbreaking. It's horrible. But it's not up for debate. She killed the kids. The blood is hers. The exercise bands are the murder weapons. The DNA matches. He volunteered to save the prosecution from calling dozens of witnesses to prove chain of custody, which was going to be the next rabbit that they pulled out of their hat. The prosecution, if they wanted to win the case, would seemingly want this emotional, devastating testimony in front of the jury. But it's out now. It's not going to be there. Are they happy about that? I mean, who does this advantage more when you pull all of those pieces of devastating testimony out? And I guess my other question is, the prosecution didn't seem all that like, you know, ready to fight to keep it in either.
Under these circumstances, sometimes the defense attorney seems like, oh, hey, we want to save the jury a bunch of time. I'm looking out for y'all. Like, this is, I want to make this easier on you guys. We're conceding this thing. And it looks like a really noble act. And perhaps it is in a sense, but also it is gaining them a tremendous benefit by not having to repeat some of the more potentially grisly and problematic details of the prosecution's case that would have been drilled into the jury's head over and over again. We're avoiding all of that. And so it not only does it look good to the jury, but tactically from defense standpoint, I think it's a super smart move.
I mean, it's a very smart move. Are you surprised at all that the judge was okay with pulling this out at this stage in the game? There was already planned for this to be a 68-week trial that was on the books. They were ready to go with it. We knew going in that that she killed the kids, that this was not really up for debate. I guess why the change of course now? Why does Reddington's argument suddenly land with the judge that we don't really need to go down this road? She's admitting to it. She has the whole time. Why do we keep pounding this into their minds? Is the judge just like, this is getting redundant and making the best decision for integrity of a trial, or what?
Perhaps. And I would have anticipated the prosecution would have challenged this measure a little bit more because really the prosecution does have a right to put on their case within the lawful parameters of the rules of evidence and everything. But if they want to say, hey, you know, we appreciate the defense would stipulate to this, but we think the jury needs the full picture. We think they need the details. We think they need the perspective here that we're going to present. And so then you just sort of strengthen some of the points, you're bolstering some of your own points in going through that process. I thought the prosecution would push back more, in which case oftentimes the judge is like, hey, it'd be nice if the prosecution would agree, but they're allowed to put on their cases they want. We're going to let these witnesses do it. But the prosecution kind of didn't put up a big fight about it.
I'm kind of surprised by that. I am kind of surprised that the prosecution didn't put up more of a fight. I'm not accusing them of this, and this is just kind of pure conjecture question here, and not necessarily about this case specifically. But have you ever seen in your career as, you know, as a defense attorney, also as a prosecutor, in just witnessing many cases, do you ever see it where a prosecutor, you know, it's obviously their job to prosecute this case, where it kind of gets phoned in at a certain point, where maybe they're not really in it to win it. Maybe they don't really believe in what they've been assigned to prosecute, but it's their job. They have to go and prosecute it. And they pull back on certain things that they too think, yeah, this is getting kind of ridiculous. Do you think that could be going on here, or does that ever go on in cases where the prosecutor is like, yes, it is my job to toe this line, but I don't even really believe the line I'm towing.
Tony, it's like you've worked in a prosecutor's office before. That absolutely goes on all of the time. You know, publicly, they've got to put on this front like, hey, we believe wholeheartedly in all these cases we prosecute, including this one. But internally, there could be some dissent. There could be some folks who are a little iffy on what the objectives of the office are and whether they pertain to this case. So certainly I've seen cases where a prosecutor, you know, sometimes their boss makes them. I'm not saying that's what's happening. Mm-hmm. But sometimes they don't necessarily agree with some of the directives they receive from the top. But it's a chain of command kind of thing in most prosecutors' offices. It's almost militaristic at times in my experience. And so that happens.
Yeah, I mean, what is that like when you're in that sort of a situation where you I mean, everybody's human. Everybody has jobs to do. I mean, oftentimes you hear this argument against defense attorneys where how can you represent somebody like that? Because everybody deserves a defense. That's why we have defense attorneys. That's we'd be in a horrible state if they didn't exist because not everybody is guilty. It's not often that it's talked about on the prosecutor end of these sort of things, but that's your job. I mean, you're working there for the government to prosecute a case. They say, here's the one you're going after. If you fundamentally disagree with it, do you have many outs? Do you ever like, I have fundamental reasons to disagree with this and I'm not your person for this case? Or is it just sometimes, well, here's what's on your desk. Make lemons out of lemonade.
Might depend on the boss, you know. I've worked in offices where if you voice some moral concern about a case, even if the boss doesn't agree with you, they might say, hey, I appreciate where you're at with that, and we're not going to make you do something that's against your conscience, and we disagree with you, and we'll put a different prosecutor on it. Sometimes that's how it works out. Sometimes it's like, hey, I don't think we should be doing this. I'm not sure this person is guilty. And the boss is like, you know, pipe down, you just kind of trudge ahead as a soldier out there. And those things happen all of the time. And those office dynamics creep into play as well. So, you know, not every prosecutor wholeheartedly believes in their case like they may present. Same with defense.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you want, you know, if you're if you're the boss and you're wanting to get a case prosecuted and you want to win your case, whoever you are putting onto the stage of the courtroom to fight the case, you want them to be in it to win it. You want them to believe in it. But sometimes you get the folks that aren't there, and then that ultimately, probably indirectly, gets communicated to a jury, and you don't always have the best of results as to where that would want to go. The toxicologist testified that every drug in Lindsay's system was at a therapeutic concentration. They're really focusing on the math here and not so much the mental end of it, meaning each one individually was within a prescribed range. Okay, great. That doesn't really tell us a whole hell of a lot. The one drug that was slightly elevated, Seroquel, still wasn't anywhere near a toxic level. But there is a woman who was on 13 different psychiatric medications here that we're talking about at the same time. The prosecution is saying, see, the drugs she was on were in range. They're not Tic Tacs. She wasn't taking the recommended dose of sugar for the day. These are powerful drugs that work differently with different people. This is not rocket science. This is just common understanding of how these sort of drugs work. The prosecution is essentially saying that all drugs work the same for everyone as long as they're in range. So it can't be the drugs that cause this. I mean, number one, it's nonsense. But even more, she had postpartum psychosis and bipolar. Even without the drugs, she could fall into a psychotic state. Why are they relying so heavily on the drug argument here when it really can very easily be debunked and fall flat, not even with conjecture, just with pure facts and how these things work?
Of course. You know, I think the prosecution's trying to say this wasn't crazy because she was being treated for crazy and the treatment appears within the therapeutic levels. So that can't be the reason. It had to be purposeful, knowing murder. But I think that rings a little hollow. Like, we all know, gosh, if you're not crazy before, if you're given a 13 drug cocktail, the chances that you are going to be at some point is substantially increased. Like, I just think all of that stuff going on neurochemically in your body, combined with the severe mental health issues of bipolar and postpartum psychosis, all of those together. And also what it looks like too, Tony, from the defense side, is that she's trying to address these things. She's not being reckless and flopping off and running in the middle of the highway or something. She's trying.
I don't know. Am I wrong for being surprised that their arguments on the prosecution side just seem to go completely against just basic understanding of how medications work? I mean, it's like they're asking the jury to live in a world that doesn't exist, in a land of make-believe on how cause and effects work with prescription medication, with psychosis. If you were to believe, I guess in the world of Massachusetts, that's a great place to have a child because postpartum psychosis doesn't exist, postpartum depression doesn't exist, none of these problems go into play, and mixing medications at different levels and all of that, they work like Tic Tacs. Everything just works great in Massachusetts, I guess, at least according to the prosecution.
Yeah, you know, Tony, I think that the higher ups in prosecution and law enforcement said, we have three dead children, and it wasn't an accident. They were strangled to death. There's got to be a crime in there. We're going to find it, and we're going to prosecute it. But as you go down that road and there are mental health evaluations, there are further details that are revealed. There are new things that come to light about a history of a person seeking help and experiencing problems, trying to contend with them. I think it really gets mucked up. Then it's not so clear that there was a crime that was committed under these horrendous circumstances. But I think the prosecutor is just too far down the lane on that they can't turn around now. And as some of the commenters have said, it looks like they're like pulling off or, you know, not totally in it.
It feels like spaghetti on the wall. Like, will this one stick? Let's see if this one does. Another one of their greatest hits that they like to pull out is the term Coleman cooperative. The prosecution put a psychiatrist on the stand who examined Lindsay days after January 24th and said she was Coleman cooperative. That's supposed to prove she wasn't psychotic. But on cross, Reddington, he got the same psychiatrist to admit that a person can be in psychosis and still appear calm and cooperative and coherent, like this is some sort of mystery. The prosecution's own expert just told this jury that looking normal doesn't mean you are normal. Does that testimony destroy the prosecution's entire theory? Is the prosecution phoning this in because they know their case makes no medical sense at this point?
Gosh, you know, I just can't help but wonder if they felt sort of pressure in the community to move forward because they have three dead kids. But then, you know, you're trying to put so what you have is this objective, and then you try to, through a confirmation bias sort of approach, tailor your case to meet that. But it's not adding up, and it's not really following in a logical fashion. And so, I think perhaps they're just trying to show, like, hey, we made the attempt at this. There are three dead kids. Did our best, and maybe they know it's a foregone conclusion that it's likely to be not guilty.
Yeah, I mean, the jury heard Reddington read from Lindsay's own journal, the diary. That was another big part of this. Entries she wrote in the weeks before January 24th. I feel like I'm drowning every day. Horrible insomnia and anxiety, which is causing depression. I want to die, written in there. The prosecution says a woman was lucid enough to document her own spiral, was lucid enough to plan three murders. The defense says those words are the spiral, caught on paper in real time. Which side does that journal help?
I think it shows a person who has had an ongoing struggle with severe mental health issues. And it's not just somebody saying that. It's not just a hired gun at the trial who's been paid to say that. This is a historical record. You know, we can see a glimpse into her head and just how chaotic and distressing and confusing that must have been. And I've got to imagine that resonates with the jury. They look at this, they could be transported to where the defendant was when she was writing that, in a sense. And I think, it shows an ongoing mental health thing as opposed to a calm, calculated murderer.
At the end of the day, the prosecution here has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that she was sane. It's not the other way around. And that's a little bit different in Massachusetts. The proof has to come from the state that there was sanity involved. And again, it feels like they're throwing spaghetti at the wall, seeing what's going to stick to do that. The prosecution has the toxicology. They have the best day. They have the calm hospital exam, but they also have 13 medications, a psych hospital admission 3 weeks out, and a woman in a wheelchair who clearly intended to die that night. Is anything the prosecution has put up enough to prove sanity beyond a reasonable doubt thus far?
I would say absolutely not, in my opinion. I don't think we're even close to that. And you're right that this is a significant wrinkle in the case, in the law, because in a lot of jurisdictions, it's actually the burden of the defense to show mental disease or defect and not being able to tell right from wrong. Here, the prosecution basically has to disprove that. And that's hard to disprove. And so in closing, if I'm defense, I'm like, hey, your jury, you don't have to decide whether she was legally insane. You have to decide if there's a reasonable doubt as to whether she's legally insane. And that's a lower threshold. It's a little easier to get there. And I think that we're much closer to that than we are sanity.
Eric, you've seen the comments on this case. You've been talking about it here. You've been talking it all over the place. I always like the comments because it's interesting. It kind of gives you an idea of like what a jury pool is like out there. Some people very much understand and see the medical end of this, the psychiatric end of this. Some people are hell-bent on not seeing it. And I don't think you're ever going to get some of them there. For whatever reason, it is. It is what it is. It's what they're dealing with. 18 people on this jury. This is not a civil case. So you have to have across the board. Everybody's got to agree. Either she, you know, did this or did not do this, or it's not that she did or didn't, but was she mentally there? Was she responsible for doing this, mentally capable of doing this, or was she basically insane? Where do you see this landing with a jury? Do you see 18 people agreeing in any direction on this case?
At the very least, just in my opinion, how it's been going so far, I think it's going to be not guilty, or at the very least, it's going to be a mistrial in which the jury cannot unanimously come to a guilty verdict. That being said, Tony, so I've talked with several friends about this, including women who are mothers, and some of them see it very differently. They see it as she could have done more to try and protect her family from herself when she had knowledge that she herself was a threat. and she, and in their eyes, she didn't do enough. So I'm just saying, I think reasonable minds could differ on it. And although I see it one way, who knows what's going to happen back in that jury room?
Yeah, I don't know. If I'm a betting person, I think I'm going on a hung jury still. I mean, even in the clear, and I think Reddington's doing a wonderful job. I have all the confidence in him once it's his turn to really take the stage here. But I don't have a lot of confidence in humans. That's where I don't think it's going to end with a clear answer. And then do they do the whole thing over again? Or does the DA just say, you know what? Maybe this shouldn't be prosecuted this way. I don't know. We'll see where it goes. Your thoughts in the comment section on Substack and YouTube. We'd love for you to weigh in and give us your thoughts over there.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast. This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
All right. Another look inside the trial of Lindsay Clancy and where things are sitting as we are wrapping up. This is our full complete week number 2, I believe, in the case. Your thoughts are welcome in the comment section on Substack and YouTube as we work our way through this. A Massachusetts State Police Detective Sergeant, he gave 2 answers on August 6th that may follow this case all the way to the verdict. Defense Attorney Kevin Reddington asked Sergeant Andrew Cacino whether investigators searched everything to find evidence that Lindsay Clancy abused her children. Did she? Cacino said, yeah, he looked everywhere. Reddington told him he found nothing. And Cacino agreed. He gave those answers as a witness for the prosecution. Cacino is the case detective assigned to the Plymouth County District Attorney's Office. One of the investigators who built the prosecution from the first night. Day 8 in Plymouth Superior Court put 11 witnesses on the stand. What they proved and which side they proved it for is the question this trial now kind of has to answer. Because as we're looking more and more at this trial day after day and prosecution bringing witness after witness to the stand, if you're objectively watching this, I would say even more so if you're not on the side of Lindsay Clancy and mental health, you might be going, why do they seem to be in Lindsay Clancy's corner? Lindsay Clancy is 35, a former labor and delivery nurse at Massachusetts General Hospital. She's charged with first-degree murder in the deaths of her 3 children at the family's home in Duxbury on January 4th of 23. Cora was 5, Dawson 3, Callan only 8 months old. She has admitted killing them. Her lawyers argue she isn't criminally responsible because she was in the grip of what's known as postpartum psychosis, a rare, very rare condition where a mother loses contact with reality after childbirth. 1 in 1,000. Prosecutors told the jury in opening statements that she was controlling and manipulative, a woman who wanted to escape the life she'd built. You know, we've seen cases like that on this program many a times of a parent wanting to escape the life that they have around them. They usually have an escape plan. They have a boyfriend, a girlfriend. They have a life somewhere else. They have this idea of where they're going to go and what they're going to do. And it's somewhat plotted. And there's a lot of evidence to it leading up to the event that is in question that ultimately leads them to court. Lindsay Clancy has none of that. Not one iota. What she has is a detailed track record of begging for help for the mental hell to which she was living in and not seeming able to find an escape hatch until it all came to a head and she lost all control and grip of reality. The state of Massachusetts wants you to believe that, well, that doesn't happen. That doesn't exist. There's really no such thing as psychosis or postpartum psychosis. Oh, it's all witchery. It's all, yeah. You know, we used to burn them for that at the stake here in Mass. And, you know, I guess they might as well still do that because it seems to be about what they believe, or at least what the prosecution is performing I don't even know if the prosecution believes it, honestly. I'm almost like, at first I was very questioning of the prosecution in this case. Like, how disingenuous can you be? How inauthentic, how many carny tricks are you going to try and play here for something that is just, your narrative is bullshit. Your narrative that these sort of things don't happen, and that because she had examples of being lucid, that proves that she can't be psychotic. Well, actually, no, it actually proves exactly that she is, because that's how that works. It's how psychotic works. It doesn't present itself always as someone sitting in the corner rocking back and forth, taking bites out of their family pets. No, they are oftentimes very active, living a normal life. And little things seem off. She knew they were off. She was asking for help over and over and over and over. How off? Well, guess what? You don't really know how off you are until you demonstrate how off you are. And oftentimes people who are that off in a form of psychosis, that's part of what psychosis is. You're not aware that you're psychotic in those moments. I don't know why any of this is up for debate. This is just medical psychology, how this works. I mean, this is not rocket science. Unless you just want to pretend that doesn't exist. Safer world, I guess, right? If people couldn't possibly be in these sort of states. I don't know. I don't know why this is a hard one for people to swallow. It's a horrible case. It's heartbreaking. I cannot imagine being there in it, but I also can't imagine living in a world where I pretend this stuff is not real. Every day of testimony gets measured against those two stories. August 6th tested both of them. Hours before the killings, Lindsay Clancy sat in a pediatrician's office with her daughter. Months later, investigators served a search warrant on her Facebook account. Both facts surfaced on August 6th. The morning belonged to Dr. Kimberly Springer, a Massachusetts medical examiner. The doctor who performed Callan's autopsy, a medical examiner, documents every injury on the body and rules on what caused the death. Springer told the jury Callan died of complications from mechanical asphyxia, which means pressure on his body kept him from breathing. The word complications is in that ruling because Callan didn't die on January 24th. He held on for days afterward. Jurors viewed the autopsy photos on screens. In front of them, Bob Ward of Boston 25, reporting from inside the courtroom, saw one juror wiping her face with a tissue. Lindsay Clancy sobbed at the defense table with her head in her hands. The judge ordered a recess because she was inconsolable. And some are like, see, she's performing. No, I mean, I've seen performance. This isn't that. Yeah, this is someone who, if you gave her the service revolver of the court officer, she might end it right there and right now. If I were a betting person, and God, I hope this isn't on a poly market somewhere, I'm going to guess Lindsay Clancy's not going to be around much longer. I'm going to guess the first moment she has a chance to exit this mortal coil, she may take it. And I can't say I don't blame her. I can't imagine. I cannot imagine coming out of some sort of psychosis like that and realizing what you did and having to square that up with now going forward and those, yeah. I'm not saying she should do that. I think that's horrible. But I, if I were in that position, I mean, if you were in that position, I don't know how I would continue. She's not a woman looking to get one over on this system and then go out on the town when she's found not guilty. No, she's already said, I just want to be institutionalized for the rest of my existence. And the state of Massachusetts says, no, we want to put you in a box with other prisoners who are evil and horrible. That's what you deserve. Like, okay, I mean, there's people that certainly deserve that. One size does not fit all in these cases. Dr. Lindsay Rothschild took the stand. Actually, has been the family's pediatrician since 2019, and she testified all three children were healthy. Dawson had a peanut allergy, and Cora had asthma. Both were under control. And on the morning of January 24th, Lindsay Clancy brought Cora in for her annual physical. Rusher described a routine appointment. She suggested Miralax for a stomach issue and saw no sign of trouble in the mother across from her. Reddington asked whether Lindsay ever complained about the children being a pain or a source of aggravation, and Rossard said no. That appointment ended hours before the killings began. The middle of the day belonged to the people who knew her best. Andrea Hennigan worked beside her for 7 years in labor and delivery at Mass General. She testified that at a lunch in November of 22, Lindsay described insomnia and brain fog and said she was in a difficult mental place. Hennigan texted her on January 23rd, the day before the killings. Lindsay replied that she was working with a psychiatrist to find the right combination of medications. Hennigan told the jury her friend was always hopeful. Reddington asked Hennigan whether Lindsay ever complained about wanting to leave the life she had. Hennigan said Lindsay had always wanted to be a mother with a big family, and she was happy to have children close in age. Bethany DeColbus, a family therapist who saw Lindsay weekly, testified that Lindsay couldn't sleep even when the children slept. At Cora's birthday party in January 23, Lindsay told her she felt like a zombie. DeColbus said she grew worried for her friend, and she also said Lindsay never spoke of hurting anyone. Reddington also asked about the marriage. DeColbus said Lindsay never complained about Patrick and that he was supportive. Amy Bevins has known Lindsay since childhood. She testified that shortly before the killings, Lindsay texted her about having dark thoughts on medication she was tapering off. The text never mentioned harming herself or anyone else. A preschool teacher, Susan Batullo, added a detail from early January when Lindsay was a patient at McLean Hospital, a psychiatric facility outside Boston. 5-year-old Cora told her teacher she missed her mom. Batullo also remembered the day before the killings when Cora kept needing the bathroom at school. She mentioned it to Lindsay at pickup, and Lindsay said she'd ask the doctor about it the next day. Kylie Kearney went to college with Patrick Clancy. He hosted the family for dinner at his home on January 22nd, 2 days before the killings. He testified Lindsay seemed quieter than normal that day, but her behavior and demeanor appeared normal, and he had no trouble talking with her. Christopher Clancy took the stand next, Patrick's father and the children's grandfather. He testified Lindsay seemed quiet at Thanksgiving and at times had a blank stare. He and his wife offered to take the children for a night so the couple could rest. Their offer was declined. Under cross-examination, he said he knew she was having a hard time sleeping and knew she didn't feel well. He called her a great mother and described the household as an all-American family, the Commonwealth. Called him. The afternoon went to Sergeant Chicano, and it started as a standard case agent testimony. He pulled surveillance video from the CVS and the 3V restaurant, the two places Patrick Clancy was sent that night while the children were attacked, as if that seems to matter or make any goddamn bit of difference in this case. He mapped Patrick's route and interviewed witnesses, including Lindsay's mother. Why? It's show. Because the prosecution is saying, well, we know you've already admitted all this, but we're just going to push your face into it further. We know you're going through hell. We know you, but you know, because the state of Massachusetts, we just got to do this. We don't believe in any mental anything. We think you're mental if you're mental. Ugh! So they're doing the dog and pony show of proving what's already been completely admitted to. Here's what they did that night. None of this is up for question. It's like filler. On June 12th of 23, Chicano went back to the house with another search warrant. He collected shingles from the back of the home where blood had been noticed. He also served a search warrant on her Facebook account and a parenting group that she posted in. Out of that account, prosecutors showed the jury one post about her son, Dawson. She allegedly wrote that every single thing with him was a battle and had been since he was around 8 months old. The post was written in May of 21. That's 20 months before the killings, about a toddler Both sides walked out of August 6th holding pieces of that same day. The defense got a two-year decline documented by the state's own witnesses. The insomnia, the zombie comment, the dark thoughts text, the McLean admission, the testimony from earlier in the trial that she had been prescribed 13 psychiatric medications. It also got the case detective confirming under oath that the search for abusive evidence came up empty. Everything that Lindsay Clancy and her family and friends have said that she is, the evidence is showing that she was a loving mother, struggling, begging for help, being failed at every step. Not someone plotting her escape from the family that she didn't love. Look, that shit exists. Why are people projecting that onto this case? I don't understand that. I really don't understand that. Although I start to question some of the folks who are projecting that onto this case, because I'm like, what's going on in your world? It's usually how some of that shit works. It's coming from in here, not from out there. The Commonwealth got something, too. Those witnesses were on its list for a reason. Witness after witness described a woman who showed no outward signs of a break. As if that's supposed to mean something. The pediatrician described a routine visit on the morning of the killings. A preschool teacher noticed no sign of insomnia or postpartum struggle, as if the preschool teacher is supposed to be able to diagnose those things. And a family friend remembered normal behavior at a dinner 2 days before. That pattern is the prosecution's argument. She functioned, scheduled appointments, and held conversations. Prosecutors say that means she knew what she was doing. Again, kind of the opposite. That just, it shows that, yes, she was lucid. She was going in and out. But what you don't have, if she knew what she was doing, quote unquote, where's the planning? Because people who are planning this sort of shit, premeditating this sort of shit, they're signs. There just is. I've seen it in many cases. I've lived it in my own personal life with someone premeditating some shit and then attempting to pull it off. That exists. Premeditated, evil behavior, narcissistic, all that totally exists. But it doesn't apply to everyone. And it doesn't apply to everyone who on the surface has done something crazy or horrible. Sometimes people do crazy and horrible things because they are in a psychotic state. There is a difference. And if you don't believe me, you don't believe me. I can't help you. But you are just simply choosing not to accept reality on reality's terms. That's up to you. I like to live here in the plane of reality. It's a little darker than I guess the world where those sort of things don't happen. But I guess it's filled with less surprises because you already accept and understand and know that all these things are possible in this great, big, wonderful world. It's a great, big, beautiful world. I'm thinking, what is it? The Disney Carousel of Progress. What's the song? It's a great, big, beautiful world or something, you know? Do a true crime version of it, where every scene is some sort of horrific thing, and somehow at the end, everybody breaks into song at the crime scene. It's a great big view, then it turns. If you know the Carousel of Progress, you know what I'm talking about. Now that would be horrific. The Carousel of Crime. When I open my theme park, that'll be the first ride. The defense's answer is that postpartum psychosis doesn't always show on the outside. And that's also the medical community's answer as well. Just not the state of Massachusetts. Legal analyst covering the trial for NBC Boston spent the evening of August 6th debating whether calling her friends and coworkers backfired on the Commonwealth. A jury that spent its morning with Collins' autopsy photos may weigh all of it differently than an analyst. The jury went home around 2:45. Lawyers stayed because the next fight will shape the entire defense case. Reddington asked Judge William Sullivan for permission to call three doctors, Elizabeth Lapisotta, Michael Volforch, and Donald Condi. A defense filing describes them as central to the case. Reddington told the judge they'll testify about the night Lindsay went out a second-story window. She dove out the window and hit her head, he argued, and suffered a debilitating spine injury. He compared it to the injury the actor Christopher Reeve suffered falling from a horse. The point of the testimony would be that her suicide or that attempt, the S-tempt, it was genuine. Sullivan took the motion under advisement and testimony is resuming. Whatever he rules on the doctors, the jury returns with the case detectives, two answers already on the record. Three children sat at the center of every hour of their testimony. Cora was five. Her preschool teacher told the jury she was a sweet girl who loved to draw, loved playing with babies, and loved Princess Sophia. The day before she died, Cora was resting on a mat at school when her mother came to get her. Lindsay picked her up and said, "Oh, come on, baby, let's pick up Dawson and go home." Dawson was three. The hardest thing anyone said about him on the stand was that preschool drop-offs had gotten difficult, that he could get clingy and might cry. His grandfather remembered getting up at Thanksgiving dinner to help settle him into his seat. Callan was 8 months old, the baby. A nanny had been hired to help care for while his mother worked on getting back to her job. He outlived his sister and his brother by days. That's where this week essentially ends. We will continue to follow this case and continue to bring you daily updates. If you'd like to listen to the courtroom audio, we bring it to you every single day on our podcast channel. There is the QR code if you're watching us on YouTube right now. Go ahead, go find us wherever you get podcasts. Press subscribe. You can listen to the show in the car, you're out for a walk, whatever, beyond just the video version you get here on YouTube. And included over in the podcast, the audio version, is the courtroom audio throughout the day. Great way to consume it if you're trying to stay abreast of this case. I look forward to your thoughts in the comments section. We'll continue our conversation there. Until next time, my name is Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers Podcast.